Hey everybody, I'm Alex, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
hey family. Okay, so God keeps reminding me that he said, Alex, it's not about you. So that's great because then you guys can be nervous. Perfect. So my sobriety date is September 7th, 2017, and I am supposed to tell you guys what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So first of all, I want to say thank you to Chris for asking me to tell my story today. It is truly an honor to tell my story, and I'm grateful for that. So I grew up in Fairfax County, Virginia. My father is an alcoholic, self-diagnosed, and my mother is an untreated Al-Anon, my judgment, and a recovering Catholic, self-proclaimed. I have two younger brothers, Jonathan and Michael. From as far back as I can remember, I felt different. We spent my very young childhood in Germany, and my mom ran the preschool kindergarten there, and playing in the yard, my girlfriends, the young girls there, I remember one time they were talking about, we're white. And so I ran home, I'm 5 years old maybe, and I was like, Mom, the girls said they're white. I said, what am I? She said, honey, you're tan. I said, okay. So that's like my first memory of feeling different. It's like, okay, so I'm tan. Got it. I remember being left out in childhood play, in the neighborhood. I remember feeling apart from, never a part of, even though growing up, I was a part of this really large group of friends, who I guess were considered the popular kids. I don't know. I just always felt different. I remember the first time that vodka was my answer. So, I'm supposed to insert my vodka story now. So, the vodka story. I'm at my friend my best friend Valerie's, my first best friend, and I thought it was so great because she, in my opinion, was the prettiest girl in school. So I'm like, oh yeah, my best friend's Valerie. And so we're at her house and her dad's away. Her brother came home from college and he brought his friend, so it's the college boys, and we made screwdrivers. And that's vodka and orange juice. I'm sure everybody knows, but just in case. And so we made it in coffee mugs. And so I'm drinking this vodka and orange juice, and I just feel awesome. Like I'm not different. I'm a part of the conversation, and I feel pretty, and all these college boys are paying attention to me. And there were no negative consequences that night. You know, we were talking about books and Ernest Hemingway, and I didn't even know who Ernest Hemingway was at that point, but I did that night. Like I was conversating it up, and we were out on the porch drinking our screwdrivers and smoking cigarettes, and I felt pretty and amazing and popular, and it was great. And I just remember going upstairs, and Valerie was on the phone with her boyfriend, and she was having an argument or something. I was like, Valerie, you're missing it. This is great. Like, it was just the best night. Didn't wake up to anybody I didn't know, didn't go to jail, it was just the best night ever. So that was me and vodka, and we were best friends since that day on. Then I'll fast forward a little bit to college, and me and my girlfriends decided to go to the club. This is freshman year of college. And so now I'm going to insert the tequila story. So before we go to the club, we're drinking Amaretto Sours. And so we pre-party with our Amaretto Sours, and then we go to the club, and then they're like, let's take shots of tequila. And I'm like, okay, great idea. And then Coronas, and we're mixing all kinds of things. And then how that night ended was I'm laying out in the parking lot, like sleeping on the ground, because it was nice and cold, and I just could feel like how nice and cold it was, and it was making me feel better. But then that ended up with like throwing up and like them having to take me back to the dorms, and it was just really ugly. And you know, in between these stories, guys, are lots of other, you know, drunken escapades and, you know, the things that, you know, other women can identify with when we get drunk and all that fun stuff that, you know, we all have those stories. So then, I remember the drunk that brought me into the rooms. Insert DUI story. Okay, so I'm driving down 75 going 95 in a blackout. I'm like in and out of a blackout. And so when I'm coming to consciousness, I kind of see out of my peripheral the cop lights, and they're sitting on the side in the dark. And like as soon as I fly by them, I'm like, I am screwed. And so they pull me over. I've had, like, I kind of remember. I think I was like at a club by myself, and somebody called me like, there's an after party. And I was like, oh, right. And I'm driving down the highway listening to Rihanna, Please Don't Stop the Music. And I'm like, I'm going. And so the cop pulls me over. He's like, how much have you had to drink, ma'am? And I'm like, you know, just a little bit. And so we go through the whole test and all that stuff, and he has me blow, and then I don't remember what it was, but then he's like, okay, well, I need you to blow again for the formal test. And I was like, well, didn't I just blow? And he's like, that one didn't count. And I was like, well, I'm not blowing again. And he's like, all right, arms behind your back. And so I'm going to jail. Okay, so he puts me in the back of the car, and I was like, well, my dad works for the government. Does that count for anything? Nope. And so I'm sitting in the back of the cop car, and I'm like, I bet I could wiggle out of these handcuffs. So I'm like wiggling my hand out, and I got out. And then, so he's out of the car doing something, and he left the window open, and I was like, I bet I could get out of here. And I'm just sitting there, and I'm drunk. So I'm like, this is probably not the best idea. So I wiggle myself back into the handcuffs, and I just sit there, and he takes me off to jail, and I go to jail, and I'm in the holding cell. And I wake up, and I was in there alone when I fell asleep. And I wake up, and I'm hungover, and I have a headache. And there's these larger women around me. And so my immediate thought is, I've seen the jail movies, you know, like I know. And I'm little, you know, I'm not, you know, in denial about my stature. So they bring the food, and I'm like, I have to assert my dominance immediately. So if I get taken to population, they know. So I'm like, give me your sausage. And so I get a sausage, and then I pick out the weak one, and I'm like, I'll take care of you. And she's like, oh, thank you. And so I got my sausage and my passive one, and I'm just like making sure everybody knows I'm the boss. And then I get my phone call. This is so dramatic. Like, I'm in the holding cell at the drunk tank in Cobb or whatever. Anyways, and then I get bailed out before I have to go to population. And like, I think I was there a total of 7 hours, but that was enough for me. Like, I knew that I'm not meant for jail. So that was enough for me. So anyways, I get a lawyer. I go through the whole thing. He's like, you don't have the DUI yet, but I want you to do all the things that you would do if you do get a DUI. So I do the DUI class, I do community service, I do AA meetings, like an AA meeting a day for like a year. And when I go to the DUI school, it's 3 days over the course of a weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. On Friday, I drive there in my alcoholism, which I know it is now. I'm driving there, and it says, don't you let these motherfuckers tell you that you're an alcoholic. And I'm like, okay, yeah, okay, I got this. I'm driving. By Sunday, they show us this video, and there were AAs on the video. And I just remember, like, this large, like, Samoan-looking gentleman, and he is smiling ear to ear, and he looks so joyful. And I'm just like, I want that kind of joy. Because just maybe 3 months prior, I was sitting in my apartment by myself, drinking this leftover E&J, contemplating, how can I successfully kill myself? And and I just wanted what he had. So I'm driving home. I'm driving to my apartment on lunch break from the DUI school, and I call my dad. He's sober like 10 years at this point. And I said, "Dad, I think I'm an alcoholic. This is terrible." And he's like, "Well, go to a meeting." And I'm like, "All right." And so like I start Googling it or whatever. I find an AA meeting. All right. And it's Highland Serenity, 8 o'clock on Sundays, and it's off Sandy Plains. And I go there, and there are, I call them my three angels. And one of them has since passed, but so they greet me, and I'm in there, and I go in, and I'm crying, and I'm a mess. And they come up, and they're like, "Oh, honey, welcome, blah, blah, blah," hug, hug, hug. And then one of them comes up. She's like, "Here's the meeting book. Here's where we keep the coffee. Here's the bathrooms. Let me take you around." She like shows me around the whole church. And so we have the meeting. I don't remember what it was about. And then I sit next to one of the other ones, and it gets to the end of the meeting, and they're giving out the chips. And the white chip is the surrender chip. And she's like nudging me. She's like, "Yeah, like get the chip." And I didn't get the chip. I didn't know, and I was too weirded out. And then the one who passed, I just made a note about her. Her name was Cindy, and I put, "She's a sassy old bird, and she was always dressed really nice, and she had all these jewels on, and she was always smoking cigarettes, and she died with 39 years sober, and she always talked about her white piece of velvet," which I think she like held on to as like her sobriety thing, like her piece or something. I'm not quite sure, but she always referenced it, and I really liked that. Anyways, so I kept coming back, and I keep coming back. I put, "Sure, I only have a few days of continuous sobriety this time around, but I'm still grateful because this program has taught me a lot." So during the past 9 years, because of this program, I've been able to stay sober and be there for my family sober for the following events. And I just wanted to take note and be grateful for these things. My cousin overdosed on pain pills, and I got to be the designated driver for my other cousins while they got drunk because they were really depressed about that. My other cousin committed suicide because he couldn't stand the thought of being like his father, who is a raging alcoholic. So I got to be there for my family for that. Sorry guys. My brother has been locked up in his room for 10 years because he's afraid to face life. I got to provide a place for him to live. After he moved out, I got to be sober for my wedding, and I got to be sober for the birth of my child. I got to be sober for my dad's quadruple bypass and my grandpa's onset of Alzheimer's. And I put, "Life's tough, get a helmet." And stay close to this program because it'll save your life, and it has saved mine. The first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. It is important for me to stay connected to the we. My current sponsor has been saying a lot about we. We have to fully concede to our innermost self that we are alcoholics. Know beyond a shadow of a doubt that without this program, I don't know how to live. I just don't. The big book is our basic text. And in it, it says that we're in an altruistic movement. That means that we think of others. And altruistic means unselfishly concerned and devoted to the welfare of others. The big book says that we have recovered. It also says that the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. On page 23. It also says that alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And my last experience with this is that I was in my garage. This is right before I relapsed last. I was in my garage, and I remember thinking, "I'm going out of my mind." And upon my return this last time around, an old timer shared, this is him speaking, "I shared with my sponsor, I'm going out of my mind. And he said, 'Gary, you're not going out of your mind. you need to get out of your mind. You're all the way in your mind. Aha moment. I was all the way in my mind and I needed relief. That was all I could think. I could not verbalize it to anyone. All I was verbalizing to my support network and to myself was my resentments. I could not say I want to die. But deep down inside, the alcoholism was saying, either kill yourself or take the drink. So I took the drink. The lesser of the two evils, I thought. So I'm blessed to be here. My sponsor taught me that every time I attend an AA meeting, I'm working steps 1, 2, and 3. Step 2 says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I believe that the program works. I've seen it work in several women I respect, period. Step 3 says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I don't understand God. I just know that if I work the steps, be grateful and don't drink and don't die, I'll have sobriety. Like my sponsor says, we don't always know right, but we always know wrong. When I'm willing to do the right thing, I'm rewarded with an inner peace no amount of liquor could ever provide. Page 317. In my last Okay. Okay. The other thing that I wanted to reference was, I didn't bring it up here, but because of this last episode that I went through in my thinking, either kill yourself or take the drink, I was under treatment of a doctor, and we were working with antidepressants, and we have an AA pamphlet that says the alcoholic and other medications, and it talks about alcoholics that take other medications. And sometimes people in here will say, well, you're an AA and you take the steps. Don't take your antidepressants. Well, that pamphlet addresses it. And if you're under the care of a medical doctor, then listen to your doctor. And it's okay. We reduced my antidepressant and it didn't work. And so she said, if you start to have those dark thoughts again, call me and we can increase your antidepressant. And I didn't call her. And so I had those dark thoughts and I drank. But as soon as I called her, she said, go ahead and increase your antidepressant. And then it was fine. So unless the AA is a medical doctor, talk to your doctor and read the pamphlet. It's really helpful. There was a lady in that pamphlet who stopped taking her antidepressant because another AA told her to stop. And that person wasn't a doctor. So I just wanted to point that out. There is literature that we have that is AA approved literature about that. And it's helped me because I struggle with that too. Just thought I'd throw that out there. Steps 4 and 5. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves and admitted to God, to ourselves and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. I will say this about these steps. Ever since my first time doing steps 4 and 5, I've never picked up the guilt, shame, and remorse from those items on those inventories again. It was like a freedom that I've never known before. It's a complete freedom. I love it. I remember doing my first 4th and 5th step with my first sponsor, and we were sitting there, and it's like this weight has been lifted from me. I don't think about those things anymore. And I'm like an open book. When people try to come and bring things up to me, like I remember walking around like with all this self-pity and like, I was a less of a person, and I don't have to do that anymore. Like, I can hold my head high, and that's beautiful to me. So if anybody's afraid of doing those steps, you don't have to be. It's great. I just did one with another woman last night, and then when we burned it, we danced around the fire, and it was awesome. And I could feel like that she was free too, and it's just a beautiful process. Step 6 and 7. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character and humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. All this is an inner choice. I do not have to work on me. This was hard for me to realize because I'm an accountant. So, I mean, I'm very goal oriented. It's like, okay, I want to achieve this goal and I'm going to make a checklist and I'm going to do it. and then I achieve the goal and I move on to the next thing. Where's my test? Check it off, highlight the book, do the thing, and then I'm boom. That's not how it works with the spiritual realm, I figured out. It's not like, okay, I procrastinate. All right, so I'm going to work really hard on procrastination and not do it anymore. It's like I have to ask God and like do things and stuff. It's really like not tangible, so it's weird for me. Like this program is the complete opposite of who I am. So I don't have to work on me. This is very hard for me because I'm a perfectionist. And then I wrote down this quote, "Of myself I am nothing, the Father doeth the works." When a situation arises and I see that there is a choice, I can A, be kind, or B, be an a-hole. In that moment, I will always want to be an a-hole, but I think it's funny and I think it's funny to be an a-hole, and my ego thinks it makes me win. But what I'm winning, I don't know. However, if I choose to pray and ask God for help, God will help me be kind. That's how I work step 6 and 7. I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's how it works for me. Steps 8 and 9. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people and wherever possible, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Okay. So I made this list when I did steps 4 and 5, and, I'll just tell my story about this. So when I did my first 4th and 5th step, there was a woman on there who I had hurt during my business excursions or whatever. I completely stepped over this woman to climb the corporate ladder. And anyways, I went to go make amends to her. And we went in the back of the office and we're standing outside smoking a cigarette. And I was like, look, you know, I had this way I was supposed to make amends to her. I talked to my sponsor. She was like, say this. So I said that. And the lady said, well, you mean when you did this? And I was like, I wasn't prepared. So I was like, yes. And she's like, what about when you did this? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, how about this? And she went on for like 12 things. And I was like, yeah, so I'm so sorry. And so I just took it as it came. And, you know, I had prayed before. I let it just kind of flow. And, so after that was said and done, I felt the relief. And then what ended up happening is a few years later, she was 48 and she got brain cancer and she died. And, thanks to this program, I got to make amends to her before she died. And what's even better is, not really better, but what was really an honor was the fact that her husband called me and said, you know, hey, Yvette wants you here. And she wanted me to be there with her while she was going through the last days of her life. And I got to be there for her and support her and her family while she went through that. And even like speak at her memorial and everything. And like all of us at work, we became a really close family at work. And it was just, it's amazing how the like spiritual gifts were given in this program to be there for people. And I wouldn't have been given this without AA. So that was a good story about steps 8 and 9. Steps 10, 11, and 12. Continue to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Still wrong a lot. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Simple. Okay, so for 10 I put, oh, I didn't like that I did that. Talk to my sponsor, make amends, ask God's forgiveness, forgive myself, move on. Insert 2010 story. Okay, so in 2010, I went to make an amends to a friend in North Carolina. This was Valerie. I had done some things, and so I went to make an amends, and I had this really bad migraine. So I was like, do you have any headache medicine? And she's like, sure. I have Tylenol and I have Percocet. I was like, I'll take one of each. And so I did, And then I called my sponsor and she's like, okay, we need to pray about this. And so I went to a meeting right after there in North Carolina. And then we prayed about it. And she was like, I'm not going to tell you to pick up a white chip or not, but you need to decide with God. So I listened to a speaker tape and it was like, the old timer on the speaker said, time doesn't matter. And so I was like, okay, time doesn't matter, whatever. And so I picked up a white chip just because I wanted to be honest about my program. And then I couldn't forgive myself though. And so I just started going in my mind about this and twirling and twirling. And I couldn't forgive myself. And I ended up in what my dad calls the nut house. And I was there for a few days. And, you know, forgiveness of self has been a huge lesson for me in this program. Like, I'm not good at it, and my ego is dead at this point. Like, white chip after white chip has just been like, I told my sponsor this time, I was like, I hate the chips. I hate them. And when I picked up this last white chip, which I'm so grateful for, I put it in the front of my book. I picked it up, and right before I picked it up, I told her I hated it. And then this guy picked up 11 years in that same meeting, and he picked it up, and he's like, yeah, 11 years. He's like, I hate the chips. And I was like, thanks, God. And so that was really cool. And anyways, we have to forgive ourselves. Like, I think that we're too hard on ourselves sometimes. I know I'm hard on myself. And it says in the book it's progress, not perfection. So it's all good. Anyways, that's the 2010 story. 11. Excuse me. Hit my knees in the morning. Ask God to divorce me from selfishness. Sit quietly after reading for a few minutes before I start my day. And do it again as needed throughout the day. Like, sometimes I'll just, like, get up from my desk and go to the bathroom or go outside to smoke a cigarette and just reconnect with God. And then one cool thing that I've seen reoccurring that happens is, like, I'll be outside and I'll be like, God, please help me with X. Like, if I get to that point finally where I'm humble enough to ask for help, like, the wind will blow through. And then I'm like, he's here. Like, I get all excited. I'm like, oh, yeah, he's here. Thanks. And then it'll be better. And then 12. My personality has changed. It's amazing. I love God and AA and you all so much for this blessing on my life. I want to give freely and I do give freely when I'm asked to be of service because I want AA to be here for the next alcoholic who needs it. My personality doesn't like to be drunk. That's why I'm here. The big book says, with few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. So I have an inner resource today that I didn't realize before, and I realize because I've worked the steps of AA, and I'll do it again. Thank you.